We all carry a lot of baggage these days, and just as the airlines are charging us bag by bag, I don't think most of us are actually aware of the hidden costs we pay in our own lives by holding on to old trauma. Dr. David Berselli has zeroed in on this repressed area in our lives and, through some amazing insights, has created and designed trauma recovery programs for individuals and group process. David is the founder and CEO of Trauma Recovery Services, and his book is The Revolutionary Trauma Release Process. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. David, welcome.
Thank you, Robin. Nice to be invited.
I bet you're in high demand these days.
I am. Actually, I'm leaving the country tomorrow to go to Norway and do some work over there.
Well, that's quite a, it seems tame in relation to other places you've been working in the world.
Yeah, it is actually tame, so, but it'll be fun.
It'll be a vacation, right?
Yeah, right. For me, yes.
Well, briefly, David, what did you see as a turning point that led you into seeing this alternative, perhaps, or insightful way to transform trauma?
What happened was, many years ago, I happened to be living in Lebanon, and Lebanon was experiencing a lot of war at that time. And so I was in a lot of places that were being bombed, and I was in buildings that were being shelled by mortar shells and things like that. And what living in trauma did, which was a very unique experience, which I could only have reflected on, but it forced me to see the human species in a situation of life or death every day. And it caused me to see, how do humans survive on the planet, or how do they live when death is looming over them so frequently? And I discovered that we have certain behavior patterns that we activate anytime we're in threat. Now, we would see those same behavior patterns in the United States, as an example, where we don't have war, but it would be less obvious. So being in war simply, in a sense, exposed them more starkly to me. And one of the patterns I recognized when I was in a building that was being bombed by mortar shells was that what happened was, every time a mortar shell would either hit the building or hit close by the building, all of us in the building, and there were eight of us in this basement of the building, we would contract very tightly into sort of the fetal position. Now, when I say that, most people recognize, oh yeah, I know what the fetal position is. So if you were standing, as an example, and you heard a large crash or a large sound or something threatened you, you would immediately contract forward, meaning ducking your head down, pulling your shoulders in, and curling up in a forward position. But you would do that automatically. It's an instinct. You wouldn't think about it. You weren't trained to do it by your mother or your father. You just automatically know how to do it. That instinctual movement surprised me, although I had seen it millions of times. What surprised me about the movement is that we all knew how to do it, and we were six people from eight different countries. Then what happened briefly after that, a few months later, I ended up going to other countries where there was war, and I discovered it doesn't matter about our culture, it doesn't matter whether we were trained to do this, has nothing to do with our belief systems, nothing. It's some sort of human instinctual movement. And so the question became, how do human beings know to make a movement towards the fetal position when they feel some sort of threat or danger? And so I began to explore, well, what part of the brain causes us to do this? Because it's going to have to be a primitive part of the brain, since it's an instinctual movement and not a trained movement, which is a part of the evolved brain. And it also has to be something that every human being knows how to do. So it must be genetically encoded in us, because all over the world, every human being makes the fetal position movement when they feel threatened or endangered. So I saw this movement and asked myself, what part of the brain makes it and what muscles create this movement? So my question after I thought about those things is, if we make those movements over and over when we're threatened, what's the reverse movement that we make from the instinctual brain as well that allows us to go back into a relaxed comfortable state of standing upright. And so I designed the exercises around that experience and those questions.
How did you see or where did you go with that? I would assume, and correct me or dive into this a little bit more deeply for me if you want, but it would seem an instinctual movement would be the proper movement.
It is exactly the right movement.
And why?
That's why we don't make a mistake. If there's a bomb outside, you don't mistakenly extend your body and hold your head up high and move your arms upright, making yourself more exposed. You do the opposite. You make yourself less exposed because in the time of danger or threat, the less you are exposed, the safer you are. So that contractual movement forward into the fetal position is, in fact, an instinctual safety position. And we don't make a mistake. You can ask any soldier, since you're in Colorado, and I'm sure you have a lot of soldiers who are listeners to your show, ask any of them if there was an explosion, they were in Iraq or Afghanistan, none of them made the mistake of sticking their head up high. They all actually ducked down, and this instinctual movement was natural to them. So that's what I was looking at, was every human being on the planet does this, so it must be a behavior pattern genetically encoded in us.
So isn't there a genetically encoded opposite that we would just instinctively do afterwards as a way of self-preservation in the best case scenario way or not?
Well, that's one of the problems that we have. There is a genetic encoding. There must be, because it would be inefficient evolutionary-wise for humans to have evolved with the encoding to pull forward into the fetal position, but not to have evolved with the encoding to let that fetal position go after the bomb or the threat is over. So yes, there's a genetic encoding, but I believe that these exercises actually help to activate that genetic encoding, which we have otherwise not activated. So here's what I mean by that. After some sort of threat or danger is over and we start to come out of the fetal position, one of the natural responses of coming out of that position is for the human body to begin to shake or tremor. Much as you see people when they get scared or nervous, their hands might shake or their knees might shake a little bit. If you're standing in front of an audience, your legs will start to shake if you're embarrassed or afraid about speaking in front of an audience. Or if you're taking an exam in college, this is a perfect example, and you're nervous about the exam, your hand might shake as you write, and you realize that your writing isn't as calm and fluid as it usually is. That shaking mechanism is a genetically encoded mechanism in the neurophysiology, meaning in the brain and the body, to actually take that fetal position or contracted muscle state of the body. And we are designed to genetically tremor a little bit to actually relax that muscle pattern and bring the body back into a normal state. The exercises are designed to evoke that tremor mechanism, because what seems to be happening to all of us, actually, is that we contract into this fetal position, or we contract forward to protect ourselves in danger, but then we end up staying held in that position without releasing it. And if we stay held in the position, it causes the brain and the body to continue to activate what we call the nervous system response, or the sympathetic nervous response, where we stay in a fight-or-flight response. So we live in that startled state, and when we live in that startled state, that's what creates headaches or backaches or neck pains or gastrointestinal problems when we're under stress or we feel nervous or we have tension in our lives. We live in that state, and that state's what causes us to have these adverse reactions in the body that we then have to go to a therapist for, or a massage therapist or chiropractor or whatever, to actually release that contracted state because it didn't release naturally in us.
This question may be terribly naive, David, but is there a chemical release during this traumatic experience, like we will build up lactic acid if we do an inordinate amount of exercise, for instance, that we're not used to? And is there some kind of chemical that perhaps sustains the problem in the body?
Well, all of the muscle contractions and the muscle expansions are created by chemical changes in the body. So the minute you're in danger, and we'll talk about the nervous system first because that's what helps produce the chemicals, The minute you're in danger, the nervous system activates what's called the sympathetic nervous system, which is sympathetic to the danger. So it activates chemicals such as adrenaline and cortisol, which we're most familiar with, but also things like opioids, which causes the body to go numb. If we need to dissociate or if we're injured, the body can often go numb and not feel the injury for the sake of survival. So yes, you have chemicals created when the sympathetic nervous system is activated, which is our fight or flight nervous system. And then its opposite, which is the rest and digest, is the parasympathetic nervous system, and there are different chemicals created during that. This becomes one of the complex problems. If you continue to live in the fight-or-flight response, okay, so the sympathetic nervous system is turned on, what happens is it means the body continues to live under some sort of threat or danger. Now, that could just be stress. This doesn't have to be a bomb. It could be a stress from the economic situation you're in, from a high stressful job, from maybe a divorce or difficulty in relationships you're having or problems with your children. We could live in chronic stress, and living in chronic stress produces the same symptoms as post-traumatic stress disorder would, and that means that we're highly activating a nervous system response in us that's creating one type of chemical, and then the body becomes imbalanced. It's flooded with a certain type of chemical, which then creates these aches and pains and disturbances in our organs and in our body. So yes, chemicals are induced, but so is the nervous system and so are the muscle patterns. So it's all connected together.
Is there an obvious difference how animals deal with stress? Have you observed animals? I can only think that you have, and or perhaps evidence in Aboriginal tribal cultures.
Well, okay, so these are two different things. I'll talk about both separately. First of all, animals in the wild, it has been demonstrated through research that they do not suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, meaning animals in the wild live in danger every day of being eaten or captured by a prey or a predator, I mean. And so animals in the wild, you would expect, would live with a tremendous amount of fear or threat in their daily lives, and yet they don't. And this is why they don't do that. Animals in the wild, when they are chased by a predator, and if they escape being chased by the predator, they have an automatic mechanism. So let's say a gazelle is being chased by a lion, and it runs away and it escapes. When the gazelle goes over to the water hole after it's safe and there's no more threat around, it will stand at the water hole and it will tremor all over its body. Many of us may have seen this, like when dogs shiver when they're afraid of a thunderstorm, or if horses fall, after a horse falls and it gets back up, it'll start tremoring or quivering all over its body. That's the mechanism that the mammal in the wild uses to turn off the fight or flight response. So after the danger is over, they automatically engage this quivering mechanism to actually discharge the high adrenal response that they created in their body to escape the threat. We as mammals also have this quiver mechanism, but we simply don't use it. And the reason we don't use it is because when we shake, first of all, it's misunderstood as though we're going into shock, or it's seen as a weakness, or we'll look vulnerable, or we'll feel like we're out of control, and God forbid we should be out of control. So we actually stop the mechanism, okay? So that mechanism is still genetically encoded in us, and the exercises I teach actually reactivate the mechanism so that the body can have its completion of the fight-or-flight response. Now, that's how it works in mammals. Interestingly enough, this same mechanism I found a lot in Africa and the Middle East, and in South America, when I was working with more natural cultures, it seems as though cultures that are more indigenous to the planet know about this mechanism and use this mechanism.
Right.
But here's how they use it. They put it in some sort of tradition or ceremony so that oftentimes in their ceremonies of becoming a man or a woman or being connected to the spirit world or their ancestors, they'll do ceremony, and many times they'll often either drink or eat foods that help induce a relaxed state in the body. And in that relaxed state, they actually induce the tremor mechanism. Now, they attribute the tremor mechanism to something spiritual or otherworldly, but it's the same tremor mechanism that the body activates when it's coming out of its, if you will, fight or flight response. Or in ceremonies, what they're doing is coming out of their natural controlled behavior and allowing themselves to go into another dimension of their mind or their body, into an uncontrolled behavior, which they then attribute to either, you know, a good spirit coming into them or a bad spirit going out of them. But the same mechanism is being evoked. I'm just claiming that that mechanism is a neurophysiological mechanism genetically encoded in us, and we can activate it at any time we want. So that when people do these exercises, they will often experience both of these experiences. They'll feel they're coming out of their fight or flight response, and many of them talk about how they feel like they're going into a deeper realm within themselves, which they call spiritual or higher consciousness, etc. And so the same mechanism embraces this whole passageway, if you will, from coming out of fear and not only just going back into safety, but even expanding our consciousness from safety into deeper safety, if you will, when we feel we're in our spiritual realm.
Yes, I've spoke a few years back with Bradford Keeney, who has spent a lot of time with a Kalahari Bushman, and he was, you know, very rightly so holding on to the fact that yoga, yes, yoga is great and meditation is great, but it was missing a big piece, and that was the shaking piece.
Yes, I was reading his stuff too, and he's one of the people who clearly saw it in the Kalahari Bushmen, and they have it in their tradition that they tremor. Tremor is not unusual to them, but this is true for many indigenous cultures. When I go and ask them, do you have tremoring in your culture somewhere? The answer is always yes, and they always have some way that they have understood and put the tremor mechanism into their society and into their religious and traditional beliefs. And so they're not afraid of it. They believe that being out of control has a very significant place in the human species, just as being in control does. Except in our culture, we all know we can't stand being out of control. We even call ourselves control freaks. We control every behavior in our body, and when we're not controlling it, we become disturbed by it. But Kalahari Bushmen, as well as other indigenous cultures, absolutely know the value of times to be in control and times to be out of control, and they balance the value of both of those experiences in their lives.
Right. I think that's partly why I have a problem with the whole ideology about being a co-creator of your life. You know, I feel like, you know, that's fine, but I feel like there's something else that I don't mind releasing myself out into that mystery.
Right, exactly. See, that's the whole point. If we want to be the most resilient being on the planet, the military talk about resiliency a lot with soldiers, and we need to be resilient during stressful times, etc. But there was research done that the most resilient mammals are the ones who both know how to be in control when they need that and how to let go of control when they don't need control. And that allows us to experience the whole realm of being human, because there are times, just to say on a massage table, how many people have gotten massage and it's only halfway through the massage do they feel their shoulders finally let go and they finally feel like, now I'm laying on the massage table. I thought I was when I first started, but now that my muscles pattern has relaxed, I realize I'm sinking into the table. Well, we have lost that ability to let go of control in ourselves, which means we're constantly living in a controlled nature in the body, which is producing chemicals basically that are overwhelming the adrenal system. So we now have symptoms in our society of adrenal overload. So it's chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia or common gastrointestinal problems, chronic back pains, etc. Those can all be examples of living an overstressed life where we've forgotten how to let go of control, which is essential for the human body to be able to do.
I want to go into another level of this. I love personally that the way you are approaching this is on a neurological level. You're not going in and talking to the person about, well, what happened when you were three? You need to let this go. There is maybe a place for that. But if you want to just start moving into the real being, which is in the moment, the shaking and the tremor mechanism is certainly the way to go. And I'm wondering here, is there a place in time where woundology or bonding with others through trauma came into vogue, or has that always been a part of the human experience and served some purpose?
Well, what basically happened in the Western world is that from the time of Freud on, we began to look at the psyche of the person. We actually came out of their natural state and said, well, what's the psyche doing? Meaning, what's our relationship with our mother and father, and how does that affect us neurologically, etc. And that field has been really, really valuable for us. And it's developed into present day what we call cognitive behavioral therapy, where we ask the client about their relationships, we ask them about the story, etc. But what I have recognized, although that has a very valuable place in the recovery process from stress, you know, letting down stress, oftentimes you talk to your family and friends about stress. They're not doing psychotherapy with you, but just telling the story is helping to bring some insight and some resolution to it. But that's not the whole process of recovering from stress or trauma. And here's why. Because you could tell that story over and over and over, and that story could be reactivating rather than what we call down-regulating.
Exactly.
So it could be re-stimulating you. And soldiers pick this up immediately. They'll come back from Iraq and Afghanistan. They'll tell you, I do not want to talk about the story, because talking about it is overstimulating them again on the story. So there's a way and there's a need to access that story purely neurologically. And by that, what I mean, psychology is about this content of the brain. It's about telling the story. Neurology is about how is the brain processing the story, irregardless of what the story is, meaning the brain won't make the distinction whether the story is from a bomb, whether the story is from a divorce, or whether the story is from childhood injury. It doesn't make that distinction. It's still neurophysiologically activated a defense response. So, as an example, when I work with soldiers, they tell me immediately, I don't want to talk about the story. I say, okay, we're not going to talk about it. Let's do something that neurologically down-regulates or deactivates or calms down the high stimulation around the story. So if it was a bombing and they lost one of their friends in the bombing, there's a high-intensity charge to that. There's an emotional charge to having lost their friend. So they don't want to tell the story about it, but they want to reduce the charge around it so that they can have access to the story without the high stimulation of the story. Now, that's purely neurological. Let's neurologically deactivate the intensity of the story, of the emotion. And then when you deactivate the intensity, they can tell the story or have access to it without the high emotional charge. So now they can tell me the story, and the telling of the story without the high emotional charge is what helps bring it to completion. So I work with both dimensions of that. And the tremor mechanism, first of all, deactivates the high intensity of the story, and then the soldier, when they talk to me, can say, let me tell you how difficult that was for me. So now they can handle the emotion of it and then integrate it as a healed story in their life. But many people cannot start by telling the story. It's got too much of an emotional charge. So they need a neurological deactivation of the emotional charge, and then they have access to the story for the sake of healing.
Yeah, and it even goes deeper, as I'm sure you know, than just an emotional charge about it. My daughter was injured in an important time in her life. You know, it was ridiculous compared to soldiers, but she was a volleyball player and they were going for state and she was injured. And when her team kept wanting to come over and, you know, oh, well, what happened and all of this, I refused to let them do that. When they entered the house, I said, she needs to recover. We're moving on from this moment.
That's absolutely important. If the person has had a trauma, and quite frankly, a physical trauma or emotional trauma from sports, the body doesn't take it up any differently as a bomb. See, it takes it up the same way. It's traumatized. Trauma is not how severe was it according to our ego's judgment. Trauma is how did the body experience it, basically. So your daughter is just as traumatized, but in a different way. Here's the deal. When I have a client, and I do cognitive behavioral therapy as well, but when I have a client and they say, okay, here's the story of where the trauma occurred, here's the injury, I tell them, that's fine. We want to keep the injury in mind, but I don't want their body and their mind regressing back to the time of the injury, because if it does, they will actually recreate the same neurophysiological injury that they had at the time of the event. But what I need is for their body and their neural pattern, or their body and their brain, to stay in the present moment, because now they have mechanisms and greater strength and resiliency of the present moment body, which is going to bring them through the recovery process. If they simply regress into the past, they can actually regress into the same neurophysiological state of the injury of the past and lose their capacity for healing. So we have to keep them in the present moment, even though they may be recalling the past. We don't want them getting lost in the past, like you said, with this oversympathetic questioning about, oh, tell me about the injury, and I'm so sorry it happened. When you do that, oftentimes they will regress back into the past and lose their capacity for healing.
David, I know you work culturally with religions and their relationship with ethnicity and politics. Do you familiarize yourself with an area's folklore? Is trauma written into a culture, and is that a good thing or a restrictive thing?
Well, if you're talking about stress and trauma, what we're looking at is every culture has a way to include it in their cultural belief, or in their belief system, if you will. So that means everything from religion to normal everyday life. I like to know, how do they take up the concept of stress or anxiety or trauma in their life? What place does it have? And what mechanisms have they already put in place in their society and their culture to understand this in life? Because every society has death in it. Death means that we've lived through some sort of trauma and we survive. But every society envisions this within their cultural and religious beliefs in a certain way.
We'll finish our discussion with David Burselli, author of The Revolutionary Trauma Release Process, next week. For any guest information, to listen to archives and share resources, it's tributariesradio.org. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.